Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. This week we present presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who assesses his Green Party run for the White House. Jamie Raskin, Professor of Law at American University, who examines the Electoral College and its role in the US political system. And William Grider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the state of American politics in the wake of one of the most extraordinary election campaigns in more than 100 years of US history. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the midst of growing political violence in the Middle East, a new human rights report by Amnesty International charges that the Israeli army is deliberately targeting Israeli Arabs for arrest and is using other abusive tactics such as beating prisoners. According to the Financial Times, the Israeli government has routinely refused access to attorneys and doctors to those arrested on the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In its report, Amnesty International asserts that the Israeli security forces have violated their own procedure, which required that youths under 18 years of age be questioned by the police only in the presence of their parents. Amnesty International claims there is a clear bias shown against Palestinians by Israeli authorities in trying to quell the recent uprising. In a recent diplomatic development, France proposed sending a small, unarmed observer force to the Middle East to talk with the Israeli and Palestinian security units and report back to the United Nations Security Council on violence in the region. So far, the United Kingdom has expressed support for this proposal, while the United States and Israel remain firmly opposed. 8 years after the end of a brutal civil war, U.S. troops are going back into the jungles of El Salvador. Over the summer, the right-wing Salvadoran government approved drug surveillance operations led by Americans. The Salvadoran opposition, led by the FMLN, the former leftist rebel movement, and now the largest party in the national legislature, firmly resists the renewed presence of US troops in El Salvador. They complain that the US anti-drug mission comes at a time when the FMLN is on the move with major victories in congressional elections and a successful healthcare workers' strike. John Lindsay Poland of the NIAC New York-based Fellowship of Reconciliation told the news magazine In These Times, "It's very sad that after the Civil War ends, that such a short time later the best that we can do is set up another military base when the country is still trying to rebuild from the war." American solidarity groups also are condemning the use of U.S. ground troops elsewhere in Central America. After a 12-year civil war in El Salvador that left tens of thousands of civilians dead, activists say more emphasis should be placed on boosting fragile civilian governments rather than bolstering the Salvadoran army. The lasting damage resulting from global warming is quite clear in the waters of Majestic Island, one of the popular resorts along the 1,200-mile Great Barrier Reef near Australia. After years of rising water temperatures, the reef is dying. Paul Huff, a research scientist with the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, recently told E!, the environmental magazine, "When we saw 1,000-year-old coral colonies bleaching and dying, we said, that's something new, at least in recorded human history." There is more bad news for the reef. Coral reproduction rates have fallen nearly 60% over the last 2 years, at a time of intense swings in water temperature. The reefs are really the canaries in the coal mine, and you now see the whole ecosystem being impacted. But Paul Huff boasts that the Australian reef, with over 400 species of coral, is in much better shape than reefs near the Florida Keys. Huff comments, "Larger, more diverse reef communities will last longer. North America is going to get hammered." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
In the closing weeks of the election campaign, pundits on TV and in print were paying close attention to Ralph Nader's drive for the presidency, as it became clear that his supporters would likely determine the next occupant of the White House. During the final 6 weeks of the campaign, super rallies were organised in half a dozen cities around the nation that attracted tens of thousands to hear the Green Party candidate rail against the two major parties and their corporate paymasters. But as Election Day approached, the Gore campaign succeeded in scaring many NADER supporters with the prospect of a Bush presidency, with many ultimately switching their votes at the 11th hour in the traditionally Democratic key battleground states. In the end, the Green Party's goal of winning 5% of the vote they needed to receive $7 million in federal matching funds fell short. During this surprising campaign, NADER and the Green Party did, however, attract enthusiastic support among students, environmentalists and union members, achieving unprecedented attention to progressive views on issues effectively ignored by both major political parties. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ralph NADER, who assesses his run for the White House and looks ahead to his role with the Green Party in the post-election period.
I think it went very well. I mean, we didn't make the 5% because we were at that level or a little higher by Sunday before the election. But the assault of the Democrats scaring the wits out of a lot of our supporters, even in states where, like Texas, where Bush is going to win in a landslide, or New York, where Gore is winning in a landslide, or California, where Gore is way ahead. And people thought, gee, you know, this is a close election, watching the national TV news. And I guess they got cold feet in the ballot box and voted for Gore. But we still came out with the third largest party in the United States by far, replacing the Reform Party, the fastest growing party. I mean, there's going to be a large multiple of new candidates in 2002 at the local, state, and national level. We came out with tremendous spirit. I think we raised enormous number of major issues that tens of millions of people are really concerned, worried, or affected by, you know, child poverty, universal health care, the diversion of public money into stadium boondoggles and other corporate welfare instead of back in the schools and clinics and public transit systems, drinking water systems, you know, all these issues and so many more, like living wage issues and issues dealing with downright consumer protection, especially in the poor and the cities that are ripped off like crazy by rent-to-own rackets and predatory lending. I mean, all these issues that Bush and Gore ignored, we raised again and again, the preservation of small farm, on and on. And it's really strange, isn't it, that 95% of the media covering our campaign just talked about the horse race. How is it going to affect Bush and Gore? Didn't talk about any of these subject areas. So given that we raised less than 1% of the money and got less than 1% of the national TV and had to surmount all kinds of ballot access hurdles in places like North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Texas just to get on the ballot, and were excluded from the debates, I think we did pretty well.
Since the November 7th ballot, Ralph NADER, the networks have brought you on for a couple of minutes. And the primary question they're asking you, of course, is about the spoiler issue, whether or not you were the cause of Al Gore possibly losing this race when all the votes are counted. But I wondered if you would address that, because you you have an interesting answer that I think is very important. You talk about the defections from the Democratic Party that we haven't seen in the last 8 years, and that being the cause of this very close race rather than your presence on the ballot.
Well, first, how can you spoil a spoiled, corrupt system to the core? I mean, both parties can't even get more than half of the voters to even go to the polls. Because people just don't think their vote doesn't matter, and the candidates are look-alike candidates. But George W. Bush, according to the CNN exit polls in Florida, polled 12 times more Democratic voters than I did. So what are we supposed to say? Well, it was George W. Bush that might cost Al Gore the election? I mean, you can go through all kinds of what-ifs. What if Al Gore won his home state of Tennessee? He'd be the president-elect now. So Al Gore could only beat Al Gore, and he did a pretty good job of it, although it's not over yet. But, you know, in four states, he won by a total of about 22,000 votes. You know, if you take Oregon, Wisconsin, Iowa, and New Mexico, and just those three states, let's just take Wisconsin, Oregon, and Iowa. The total number of votes that he won by, it was 17,000 votes. So, I mean, those weren't supposed to be close states. I mean, Bush didn't even spend much time in those states. Bush took off the Sunday before the election. That was a mistake. He took off Election Day, and he really ran a very casual campaign. He didn't overwork. As someone said, Ronald Reagan would have been proud of his schedule. And still Gore has trouble defeating this bumbling Republican governor from Texas with a terrible record. What does that say about Al Gore? It says that people don't believe him. They don't trust him. And I can't say they're all mistaken. The man cannot give a straight answer to a straight question.
Ralph Nader, just one final quick question here. What's going to occupy your time over the next couple of years? What are you going to be focusing on vis-a-vis the Green Party?
Well, I want to encourage more people to be candidates for the Green Party at the local, state, and national level. We expect thousands of them in year 2000. There were hundreds of them this time around. There were a few dozen in 1998. So you can see the projection is encouraging. We would like to have Green Party student chapters at colleges and universities around the country. We'd like to have a Green Party presence in Washington to lobby Congress with the prospect of taking more votes away if the two parties don't shape up and respond and care for the American people instead of surrender to big business lobbyists in return for cash into their campaign coffers. So there's a lot of work to do, and that's why we want to hear from your listeners.
That was Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. The Green Party can be contacted at area code 202-265-4000 or visit their website at www.votenader.org. The amazing closeness of the US presidential race drew the attention of the world and the financial markets as the outcome was delayed for more than a week. As ballots were counted and recounted, the Gore and Bush campaigns sent armies of lawyers to Florida to wrestle over that state's 25 electoral votes, essential to either candidate's final victory. Although Vice President Al Gore was more than 200,000 votes ahead in the national popular vote count, many American citizens were unaware that the Electoral College, not the voters, actually selects the president. The architects of the US Constitution instituted the Electoral College system as a break on the popular will and to prevent voters in each state from electing their own favorite son candidates. The Founding Fathers' concern that voters in each state would naturally choose their own politicians for the presidency grew out of the reality that information about candidates from distant states was non-existent or extremely difficult to obtain in that era. The institution of slavery was another factor in establishing the Electoral College system. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jamie Raskin, Professor of Law at American University, who examines the origins of the Electoral College and the opportunities that may now exist to reform the U.S. political system.
One of the big debates at the Constitutional Convention was when it was decided that the House of Representatives would be a body constituted by the people and by population. The question became, well, who counts for the purposes of population? And there was a large slave population in the South. And the northern states took the position that, well, these people are not recognized as citizens. They're not recognized as voters. The southern states are not giving them the right to vote. They shouldn't be counted for the purposes of the census. The southern states said, no, they should be counted for the purposes of the census. And that would obviously build up the number of U.S. House seats that the southern states would be awarded. That resulted in the compromise that became known as the infamous three-fifths provision, that the slaves would be counted as three-fifths citizens for the purposes of reapportionment. So the Electoral College, because it's based on the number of House seats you've got plus the number of senators, which is two in every state, gives disproportionate influence both to smaller states but also at that point to the southern states, because the slave population artificially swelled their population, both for U.S. House representation and also for the Electoral College. Now, after slavery, that particular kind of, political inequity was lost with the abolition of slavery. But The fact remains that the Electoral College still gives disproportionate power to smaller states.
Where do you stand on abolishing the Electoral College system?
We have had an historic movement in stages towards democracy in America. And sometimes we go backwards, and sometimes we go forwards, and sometimes we go sideways. But the general drift, as you look at it over the long history of the country, is in a more pro-democratic direction. And it really is an antique. It's an anachronism. It doesn't quite fit our circumstances anymore. I mean, there's a logic for it, perhaps during a time when we had much less effective communications nationally, much less effective transportation. But we really are a nation. For the purposes of presidential elections, and the elections should be fought that way. And in addition, you know, what happens is that the candidates end up spending, you know, 90% of their time in 10% of the states, which is what you saw here when it all came down to five or six battleground states, Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Oregon, and so on. Large parts of the country were completely ignored. You know, Texas was ignored because it, you know, didn't make sense for the Democrats to go down there. New York was ignored. Connecticut, because Senator Lieberman was on the ticket, completely ignored. The Democrats took it for granted. The Republicans, you know, just surrendered. I don't know how healthy that is. I mean, what that meant was there was tremendously good turnout in Florida, where so much of the election took place, and very weak, limp turnout in parts of the country which didn't really see an active campaign.
You know, it's surprising. I heard some commentators this week of this undecided election talk about their fear of the undiluted will of the people, saying it's dangerous and should be reined in. Is this mindset still at play, you think, in terms of justification for the Electoral College?
Yeah, I think what you'll see is the emergence during this debate is sort of the deep-seated conservatism of part of the population, which basically fears and distrusts majority rule and democracy. And, you know, remember whatever the tactical differences were between the Democrats and the Greens here, if you add the Democrats and Greens together, you clearly get a majority of the population. Hopefully there's some kind of modus vivendi worked out between Nader and Gore and the Democrats. But, you know, a majority clearly wants to move the country in a more progressive direction. I think that the Republican Party will probably end up standing for preserving this way of doing things.
Before you go, Jamie, I wanted to ask you this. This is a very unique time and juncture in American history, and maybe an opportunity to make some changes in our electoral system. What are the chances, do you think, that the American people will become actively engaged in pursuit of constructive change versus the self-interest of those politicians who like the system just the way it is, fine, thank you, and are going to be an obstacle to any kind of change?
Well, one very positive thing that's already begun to emerge from these events is a much more intense interest and engagement with politics. And I think that people are so transfixed and fascinated by what's taking place that there's going to be a lot more energy and mobilization around the 2002 elections. And I think also it's going to be a lot easier to have a meaningful public dialogue about the question of the Electoral College, about campaign finance reform, about ballot access rules, about opening up debates, and so on. So, I think suddenly all these democracy questions are on the table, and I think there will be energy and imagination brought forward to discuss where we should go from here.
That was Jamie Raskin, Professor of Law at American University. with, tongue-in-cheek, Cuban leader Fidel Castro and Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe offered to send representatives to Florida to observe and provide assistance in resolving the confusing endgame of the 2000 presidential election. The United States, long the self-proclaimed beacon of democracy the world over, now finds itself in the midst of an extraordinarily close election where Democrats and Republicans were engaged in a blatantly partisan legal brawl to determine a winner. Until the November the 7th election, most Americans saw their nation as a model of democratic ideals, where one person, one vote was valued above all else. But with votes tainted by defective paper ballots, allegations of deliberate disenfranchisement, and an archaic electoral college system that supersedes the sanctity of the collective will of the people, citizens are beginning to question the perceived superiority of their system. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with William Grider, The Nation magazine's national affairs correspondent and author of the widely acclaimed book, Who Will Tell the People? The Betrayal of American Democracy. Grider considers how our nation could benefit from the public's current focus on the flaws in our system, to reform it, and mobilise citizens to challenge the major party political orthodoxy.
I think it's a very serious moment of anarchy in which the authorities seem to have lost control of events, at least momentarily. And that should stimulate people to consider not just who won this election, but a lot of other questions about their decayed democracy. And I think, actually, in a clumsy way, that may already be happening. The establishment, and I mean that in a bipartisan sense, in and out of politics, has a very cynical regard toward ordinary citizens, and particularly their electoral decisions. So they're saying, well, let's get this over with. It doesn't matter that much who won. We have to defend the legitimacy of the system, and we have to get on with it. And I think that's quite dangerous to rush this outcome. I think we should be very deliberate and take our time and count and recount and do whatever it takes to satisfy people that the outcome is fair.
You know, I think it's pretty clear to see the American people are watching a situation where we're seeing, you know, raw evidence of bald-faced partisanship. And do you think the result of this will see more people alienated from the system or more people attracted to it to change it and fix it?
I think both. I think the people who don't pay much attention at all, and probably many of whom don't vote anyway, will be sort of brought up in their seats a little bit by this event just because of the weirdness of it. And if they pay any attention at all, some of their suspicions about politics will probably be confirmed. Whether that makes them even more alienated or stirs them to some sort of engagement, who knows? But I think there are a lot of Americans who have quite passively drifted along accepting the civic mythologies and trying to do the right thing as citizens and so forth. I think that's where the anger is. And I think that's very healthy.
William Grider, when it comes to this particular unique moment in history, what do you think we can do as a people now, those who have been jolted upright, as you said, to take a look at the system and its flaws? We have vast problems with large donors really controlling the agenda of our politics. We have the winner-take-all system, which certainly disenfranchises a lot of people. And then, of course, you have this electoral college, which is questionable, I think, from any point of view. Do you think we're going to see people take advantage of this interesting place and time?
I sure hope so. I mean, look, you always have to be optimistic about the possibilities, and I always hope to be. I think this is one of those rare, maybe brief moments when the veil has fallen off a lot of stuff. And the people should seize it at any level they can. And I mean literally, people should make a lot of noise and demand some deeper explanations for how this system got to where it is. And I'm not just talking about the outcome of this election or even how screwed up the election machinery is, but, you know, how has it happened, for instance, that You have this House contest this year, which we're told over and over again is intensely fought out between the two parties. Well, there really weren't 10% of the members of the House who faced a serious contest this year. And we all know what that's about. It's about money, and it's about safe districts carved out between the two parties. Why are third parties and fourth parties and other voices that want to be heard so pushed out of the way by law? I mean, the laws are stacked against anybody who doesn't call themselves a Democrat or a Republican. I mean, and there was a time when that could be justified because those two parties really did speak for most of the country. They don't anymore. They just don't. And people ought to demand reform. People ought to demand public financing for challengers so that you don't have to be a millionaire to at least get in the contest with at least a chance of being heard and even winning. I mean, it's a fairly long list of things that are wrong with our democracy. And I think, you know, half of the country doesn't even bother to vote. And their perceptions, some of them are screwball, but a lot of them are dead on. They understand that this system isn't about them anymore. And so they're just not going to bother. I regret that, but I think their perceptions are not altogether inaccurate. So I hope this crisis stimulates people to shout back in any way they can. If it means going down to the public square and pointing their finger at the local county officials or bombarding talk radio or whatever, I'm for unruliness at this moment. I think it would be good for the country. I mean, I was saying in a piece I have coming in this next issue that who knows if this thing goes on long enough, maybe it will light the fuse for our own spontaneous democracy movement, American style. And I said, there's no need to bomb television transmitters or set fires at the Capitol. We're not Eastern Europe, but it will be very healthy for the country if people stay mad for a while. And I mean that quite sincerely.
That was William Grider, National Affairs Correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his columns on the web at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203 331 9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, at 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Tarr. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Rees and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullins.